Get out of jail free. To most people in the world, this evokes many happy childhood memories playing Monopoly. But during World War II, Britain sent its prisoners of war, locked up in camps in deepest Germany and occupied Europe, escape kits disguised in Monopoly boards. This is a real get out of jail free story. Hi, and welcome back to the Historical Crimes and Criminals podcast. I'm Steve, your host. When I was growing up in Glasgow in the late 70s and the early 80s, I basically had three real passions. Firstly, there was football in the park, sometimes 20 a side, honing skills and dreaming of winning the World Cup for Scotland. That was the dream. The reality was to stop a mitre football, mid-flight, full force, and giving me my first semi-permanent tattoo of a ball print on my inner thigh. These balls were direct descendants of Civil War cannonballs, and many adults of that generation now shudder at their memory. Secondly was books. Living 200 metres away from the library, it was a temple for myself as a bookworm. I remember getting a copy of Lord of the Rings as a 12-year-old and reading it every winter evening for the 3 months it took me to read it. As I used to be walking home from school in the snow or the rain, I would fantasise that I would soon be gobbling down dinner and retire to a world of hobbits. The last interest was gaming, both computers but also board games. I played many games, but probably Monopoly was the game that the whole family could play, and it brought out a competitive side that you could elicit a secret revenge on your older siblings or your parents by besting them. The origins of Monopoly begin in the early 20th century. Elizabeth Maggie invented and patented the game, the Landlord's Game, in 1904. A copy of the patent and the board is on my Twitter group page. She was a Quaker, invented the game to teach people Georgism. This is an economic ideology holding that whilst people should own the value they produce for themselves, economic value derived from land should belong equally to all members of society. Elizabeth and other Georgists formed a company, Economic Game Co., in 1906 to produce games. They approached Parker Brothers in 1909 with a view to publishing two games. Whilst the other game was accepted, the Landlord's Game was rejected. The Landlord's Game, however, slowly gained a cult following, with various people even drawing their own boards. It was even published in the UK in 1913 under the catchily titled Brer Fox and Brer Rabbit. Elizabeth's original patent expired in 1923, but she renewed this patent with a slightly new board. In 1932, in Philadelphia, Charles Todd and his wife invited his childhood friend, Esther, and her husband Charles Darrow for dinner. After dinner, they played a new game to Darrow called the Landlord's Game. Darrow was intrigued and he asked for a written set of the rules. Charles Darrow had been born in Philadelphia in 1889. He was an unemployed salesman who was struggling following the stock market crash of 1929. Charles sat in his kitchen, reinventing this game that he had played. In his memory, He envisaged the board being on the streets of Atlantic City, where he'd spent his summers. He drew the board on his kitchen tablecloth and fashioned properties with bits of wood. With little else to do during the Depression, he soon found that he could make these sets and sell them locally amongst friends for $4. He then offered the game to department stores in Philadelphia, and orders increased to the point where he decided to go to a games manufacturer. On approaching Parker Brothers for the first time, he was turned down. It was explained that the game contained 52 fundamental errors and it took too long to play. Undeterred, Darrow hired a friend who was a printer to produce 5,000 copies of the game, and he managed to sell these locally to department stores. Darrow initially had suggested using everyday items such as buttons as tokens, but Darrow's niece suggested that the pieces be from a girl's charm bracelet. Then luck smiled on Darrow. A friend of Sally Barton, the daughter of Parker Brothers founder, George Parker, had bought a copy. She loved it, showed Sally, and it came to the attention of Parker Brothers president and the husband of Sally, Robert Barton. Robert and Sally bought a copy and arranged a meeting with Darrow. He offered to buy the game, but giving Darrow royalties on all sets sold. Darrow accepted and allowed Parker Brothers to amend some of the rules to develop a shorter game. Again, Darrow's 1935 patent can be seen on my Twitter group, the Historical Crimes and Criminals podcast. Parker Brothers started producing Monopoly in 1935. The game became wildly successful. On realising similarities and a potential lawsuit, Parker Brothers negotiated to buy the patent for the Landlord's Game from Elizabeth in 1935 for $500. They then produced a small number of copies of this game to secure the copyright. These copies of this game are the holy grail amongst Monopoly collectors. Parker Brothers also had to buy the rights for $10,000 to another game called Finance that had originated in 1932 and had already sold 10,000 copies. It had a number of similarities, including such cards as Community Chest, Rolling Double means extra throw, and paying to get out of jail. Darrow also appeared to have played this game and appropriated his ideas for his Monopoly game. Parker Brothers renegotiated with Darrow over his future royalties after he admitted he'd played these games. The UK game rights were sold to Leeds firm Waddington's in 1936, and with the street names changed to London, it became a staple through the austerity of 1930s Britain. Iconic geographical errors occurred, including the naming of Bond Street and Marlborough Street. In reality, there is only New Bond Street, Old Bond Street, and Great Marlborough Street in London. Waddington's boss, John Victor Watson, had taken his secretary Marjorie Phillips on a day trip to London. They took a taxi ride around London to look for suitable locations for their UK game. It was while speeding around and glancing at street names that were relatively near each other that the errors were made, but all the iconic locations we now cherish were plotted. Just imagine if there'd been roadworks necessitating a different route though. Other countries soon bought the rights to Monopoly and produced localised variations, including a 1936 version based on the streets of Berlin. However, the game was soon banned by the Nazi Party, with few original surviving copies remaining. By 1939, Europe was at war. It had been looming for years, and plans had been put into place by most countries in the greatest war ever known to mankind. Britain had instigated various intelligence agencies, all responsible for various covert operations. This included such departments as the Special Operations Executive, responsible for training and planting spies in occupied Europe, and Naval Intelligence, of whom Ian Fleming would use his imagination to defeat Germany, just as his James Bond would later thwart various supervillains. By 1940, most of Europe was in Axis hands, and only Britain and its Commonwealth stood against total victory for the Axis. In comparative terms, if it had been a boxing match, the towel would have been thrown in. However, the Battle of Britain was fought over 4 months, from July to October 1940, by the brave British, Commonwealth, and various pilots from occupied countries against German Luftwaffe in the sky. Without air supremacy, Hitler was forced to call off his planned invasion of Britain, believing Britain could be held in a siege position and starved towards an inevitable surrender. Hitler then made his biggest mistake by turning his attentions to the sleeping bear that was Russia. If you want to know more about the Battle of Britain, I would recommend Ray Harris Jr.'s magnificent podcast, The History of World War II podcast. It has been going regularly for 10 years and we've only reached 1942. It really is that detailed. Great for a history geek like me. Battle of Britain starts at episode 41. But back to the story. During World War II, around 232,000 Allied prisoners were captured and imprisoned in European prisoner war camps. Ranks and different services, as a general rule, were initially sent to different camps, although a mix was generally present in all the camps. All flags were for officers and stalags for enlisted men. Life in these prisoner of war camps was generally a very miserable, unpleasant experience. British and Commonwealth prisoners, in relative terms, received better treatment than other nationalities, particularly the Russians. Out of an estimated 5.7 million Soviet prisoners of war, 3.3 million died in captivity. It was no surprise that the Soviet Union took their retribution when their chance came. Comparatively, around 8,500 Allied prisoners died at the same time. The captured Allied prisoners were meant to receive 1,900 calories a day, but in reality, they received around 1,500. On average, the prisoners of war lost around 18 kgs or 40 pounds in weight. After the war, prisoners of war would say they could think of nothing other than food due to this slow starvation. It was probably only due to Red Cross parcels that many more Allied prisoners didn't die. In 1864, the First Geneva Convention codified an international treaty that covered the sick and wounded soldiers on the battlefield. Countries were invited to sign this treaty. An updated treaty was signed in 1929, after World War I, where deficiencies had been shown to prisoners of war. It ratified the need for adequate feeding, forbidding the pressure to supply more than minimal information and the delivery of supplies by agencies like the Red Cross. During World War II, 20 million Red Cross parcels were sent. A typical British parcel could be shared by up to 4 prisoners, and they would include the following: 110 grams of tea, tin of cocoa powder, bar of Cadbury's chocolate, tin pudding, tin of meat roll, a tin of processed cheese, a tin of condensed milk, tin of dried eggs, a tin of sardines, tin of margarine, a tin of sugar, a tin of vegetables, a tin of biscuits, a bar of soap, and 50 cigarettes. But the short delight of one of these parcels could only temporarily stop the slow starvation and the boredom of these camps. These prisoners dreamed of escape. Some were so determined to escape that we looked to stories like that of Douglas Bader, who was a British ace who, despite losing both his legs in an air accident in 1931, fought in the Battle of Britain. After his plane was shot down, he bailed out over France in 1941 and he was captured. The German ace, Adolf Galland, and his squadron was so taken with Bader that they took him to their airfield and treated him like an honoured guest. He was shown the German planes, and Bader even made the squadron laugh by suggesting he take one of their aircrafts on a test flight to see how it handled. On bailing out, Bader had lost one of his artificial legs. Galland arranged a British plane to have a safe flight to drop off a spare leg. These acts of kindness did not stop Bader trying to escape numerous times, resulting in the Germans threatening to take his legs away from him and eventually sending him to Colditz. Escaping was fraught with peril, and when 76 prisoners escaped from Stalag Luft 3, only 3 escaped and 73 were recaptured. When Hitler heard of this, he was furious, and he ordered that 50 of the recaptured be executed. This story was written by fellow camp inmate Paul Brickhill as the novel The Great Escape, which was also turned into a Hollywood film starring Steve McQueen. Ah, Steve, such a legendary name. But the desire to escape was overwhelming, and every prisoner of war camp in occupied Europe had an escape committee. They decided which escape plans were most likely to succeed, and they directed resources towards giving these escapers every chance of a home run to neutral territory and eventually back to Britain. The committee had an ingenious team who were able to perform such skills as printing forged papers and amending clothing to ensure they blended in with the area which the prisoners were escaping from. And despite the risk, there was plenty of prisoners willing to take the risk. MI9 was the British department responsible to escape and evasion efforts. It would work with resistance groups to help prisoners and downed pilots as yet captured to reach safe land. It was relatively poorly funded and was based in room 424 of the Metropole Hotel in Northumberland Avenue. One of their most ingenious intelligence officers was Christopher Hutton, known as Clutty. Hutton and the team invented a variety of imaginative products, such as magnetised razor blades that would point north in water, hollowed heels with packets of dried foodstuff for airmen, and blankets marked with invisible ink that would show up when soaked with cold water. These templates could then be cut and altered in the camp to make civilian suits. MI9 didn't send anything in Red Cross parcels to ensure they didn't breach the terms of the Geneva Convention and risking the Germans withholding future parcels. They instead used a variety of false charities to send items such as playing cards, chess sets, and tennis rackets. The Germans were happy for the prisoners to receive such items, as they caused less trouble if they were playing games and leisure pursuits. Pat Reed was a prisoner in Colditz, and he told a story of being excited at receiving records to play. One prisoner took his out of the package and it fell and smashed. Inside was money and identity cards. Reed said, "We smashed all the others, but found no more goodies and lost all our records. Crucial to any escape was a map, and it was determined that printing escape maps on silk would produce a quiet and durable map while still providing the prisoners with crucial information such as escape routes and landmarks. Silk wouldn't tear or dissolve in water, and it would be light enough for the user to pack it into a boot or a cigarette pack at a moment's notice. Luckily for MI9, in Britain, one manufacturer was capable of printing on silk. By sheer luck, it was also the manufacturers of Monopoly, Waddington's. They, as it happened, were already using silk printing technology to produce silk prints in things like theatre programmes. The company was approached and was more than happy to do their part in assisting with the war efforts. In the company HQ, a separate secret team worked producing boards which at first glance looked the same as the others being produced elsewhere in the factory. Once the escape committee were informed of these boards, they would scrutinise each new arrival for the telltale sign that it was in fact an escape kit. These were dots strategically placed on the board which at first glance would appear to be manufacturing printing errors. With prisoners of war camps in various European countries, boards had to be tailored to suit the geography. A full stop after Marylebone Station, for example, would mean Italy. A stop after Mayfair meant Norway, Sweden, and Germany. And one after Free Parking meant Northern France, Germany, and its frontiers. Boards designed for normal play were marked patent applied for with a full stop to ensure they wouldn't be torn apart. These boards would also have pieces that would be taken apart to reveal such items as compasses, gold pieces, and Swiss Army knives. The silk mats would be located under the boards. Once it was discovered, the German guards were not searching the Monopoly sets themselves. Real currency was included in the packs of Monopoly banknotes. There are no surviving boards or pieces from these Monopoly games, as once the escape aids were removed, the games were destroyed, lest they fall into German hands. The games destined for POW camps were custom made, and the few that remained after the war were destroyed to keep the practice secret in case it was ever needed again. It is estimated of the 35,000 escaping Allied prisoners of war, 10,000 escaped with the aid of Monopoly. They would then return to active service, helping to defeat Germany. After the war, many Nazis accused of war atrocities were tried at Nuremberg, and they were subsequently executed by hanging. Christopher Hutton died in 1965, his deeds virtually unknown due to it being under the Classified Secrets Act. Come on BBC, if there's a drama to be made, there it is. Charles Darrow died in 1967, a millionaire. Monopoly remains one of the world's favourite board games. Well, that's all for another episode of the Historical Crimes and Criminals podcast. Come and view the pictures of this episode on the Twitter page, the Historical Crimes and Criminals podcast. As always, subscribe, tell your friends. Until next time, bye-bye.